had to do one in a few months, but you know, nice to get back into it. My goal is to take 4 months off.
Yeah.
But for there only to be like 2 months of no podcast.
Yeah, I'm generally speaking pretty technologically challenged.
Ah.
So.
Well, we got it figured out, though.
Yeah. I ran out and grabbed this morning because I realized I didn't have a headset that had been made in this century. And I have a really nice JLabs external microphone and paperweight. I don't know what the deal is there, but.
So, Ryan, let me ask you. You believe that the Holy Spirit inspired the creation of the pipe organ specifically for use in church music because it's the way God wants to be worshipped, right?
I believe in things done properly. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay. All right. That's good. That's good. Tell me more. What is things done properly? What does that mean to you? What does that look like?
Well, I'm a pretty up church kind of guy. I mean, smells, bells, candles, that sort of thing. I have a bit of an interesting story. I was actually raised a Methodist.
Oh.
And then went through a stint in the ELCA and then ended up in Missouri. So, it's the gradual climb to the high church way of things, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Some Methodists are pretty high church, huh?
Yeah. I'm a rural small town Iowa guy, so there really is almost no such thing as high church in this part of the world. You know, it's how great thou art and home we go.
Right.
Particularly amongst the Methodists, but I would actually say, in my geography, the LCMS is the high church in this geography. They're definitely more high church than the Catholics.
That's fascinating. Do you play the organ?
I will. This Christmas Eve, I will have played the organ for 20 years.
Wow. What is the difference between an organ and a piano?
Well, first off, organs are cool.
Yeah. Okay. Based.
So, excuse me. So a piano, let's start with basic physical differences. The piano is strung with a bunch of metal strings on the inside, and when you press a key, there's a hammer that goes forward and strikes the wire and makes a sound.
Right. Okay.
And so there's several wires per key. And
is piano a stringed instrument then?
Technically speaking, I suppose you could say so. The piano is an evolution of the harpsichord.
Okay.
So in, say, Bach's time, 300 years ago, they didn't have pianos. They had harpsichords. And a harpsichord works by the same mechanical means, except instead of striking the string with a hammer, it would pluck it with a little quill. Which, if you've ever heard harpsichord music, you get that sound. It's kind of ting, 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 ting. One of the side effects of that is you can't vary the volume on a harpsichord. It will only ever play one volume, no matter how hard you press the key.
Oh, I see.
The reason the piano is called the piano is from the French pianoforte, which means soft loud. Because it was essentially a harpsichord that could play soft and loud. The organ, on the other hand, has a completely separate family tree. A true pipe organ works by pressurizing air and then blowing it through a set of pipes, which then resonate at different pitches and create sound.
Like a wind instrument.
Yeah. And that's the 30,000 foot version of how an organ works. You pressurize air,
yeah,
and then you stabilize it and blow it through a bunch of pipes.
That's fascinating.
And by bunch, I mean hundreds or thousands.
How old are... Yeah. Oh, yeah. How old are pipe organs?
So the concept of the pipe organ is an ancient Greek invention. A guy named Chastebius. That's butchering the Greek.
That's
I'm
fine.
Sure.
No one here speaks Greek.
Who took the principles of Archimedes and used water to pressurize air and blow it through a pipe. The pipe organ comes to Europe as part of the inheritance of the Roman Empire. We think the Colosseum in Rome probably had one. But then with the fall of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century, as with most things, all knowledge of anything complicated went out the window. And it's reintroduced to Europe during the reign of Charlemagne, when one is sent from Constantinople as a gift from the Byzantine emperor. And it's in the court of Charlemagne where they go, you know, these are really cool. And we can do all sorts of things with them, and we can stick them in the back of our churches. And you have to put yourself in the mindset. I think about this quite a lot when I teach beginning organ students. I always do a music history component. And this is one of my favorite things to talk about. You have to put yourself in the mind of the medieval peasant who walks into a church and hears this thing.
Yeah.
It's instantaneously impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That's kind of the beginning of the organ as a church instrument is in the 900s, in the early Middle Ages.
It's impressive. I'm not an English medieval peasant, and I don't think. And it's impressive to me, and we just have like a little electric organ, but it's such a full sound, and it's so rich, and I can only imagine actually coming through pipes and barreling around a big cathedral echoing, you know, I can only imagine. It's got to be intimidating even.
So you put this instrument in the hands of the creative people of the early Middle Ages. And from then until now, you know, we've had, well, 1,500 years to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you walk into any decently appointed pipe organ chamber, and on the back wall, there's pipes that are over 30 feet long. And up on the front wind chest somewhere, there are pipes that are less than an inch long. And it's to do with the physics. You know, obviously, shorter pipes, higher pitches. Longer right. pipes, lower pitches. You get a set of 32-foot bass pipes going, and that's not a sound that you hear. That's a sound that you feel.
Right.
It really is a powerful thing. I would say, with the possible exception of a synthesizer, you've got the largest auditory range you can possibly have available. I mean, it's everything from so low you can't hear it to so high you can't hear it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly if we're talking analog, right, analog channels, yeah, I would say then the highest possible range. I can't think of another instrument that has a range like that.
So
within one instrument.
I had an organ student probably a year ago who made the comment to me when I was explaining all the families of stops and all the different things and the different combinations and the sounds you can make. And he looks at me and he goes, "So it's like a Baroque synthesizer, basically." And I'm like, "That's pretty much exactly what they were trying to do."
That's cool. That's cool. How does it, how did it end up looking like a piano? Did it always look like a piano?
So you'll find a lot of them that are actually, the keyboards are reverse color. So the white keys are black and the black keys are white. There's all sorts of different arrangements. So the keyboard layout is a standard keyboard layout. You have your 12 pitches and they repeat over and over and over again. The organ keyboard is actually shorter. It's only 61 notes. A piano is 88. And then you have several of them because, you know, when we think of an organ, there's at least two usually.
Yeah.
And that is so you can have different combinations on each keyboard. So you could play a solo line on one while playing the accompaniment with the other hand on a different keyboard and with your feet, of course.
Because there's a foot keyboard down there.
It's called a pedal board. That's what makes organists cool.
Yeah.
It's the only instrument I know of that you play with your feet.
I mean, how coordinated do you have to be playing one line with one hand, a different accompaniment with the other hand, and then a third thing with your feet?
So
I can't get my head. It took me probably 5 years of consistent practice to be able to sing and play the guitar at the same time.
So playing in three parts is not that bad, especially if they're three parts that are moving together. But then
I would like to say that if you tell me, if you are about to tell me that you can play more than three parts at a given time or more than four parts, I'm going to lose my mind because you only have the two hands.
So enter a guy, and here we come. Here we come full circle back to the Lutherans. Enter a guy named Johann Bach.
Heard of him.
Full disclosure, I believe Johann Bach to be the greatest musician who ever lived. And you're actually not going to get a lot of argument from people about that.
No, not generally.
The only possible competitor is Mozart. So, for instance, Bach famously, I once had a teacher tell me that Bach must have been an octopus because you have to have that many arms. And Bach is the height of complexity at times. Sometimes he's unbelievably simple and sometimes he's unbelievably complex. And Bach's music is infused through and through with symbolism and theology and all these things. To the point where in some of his later work, the actual music kind of takes a back seat to the numbers and the symbolism and the things he's trying to do. And you end up with some fiendishly difficult things to do. So, as an example of how complex you can get, in the Baroque period, in Bach's time, they would have these, what we would now call like a jazz combo, where you would have somebody playing a harpsichord or an organ, somebody playing a cello, playing the bass line, and then you would have two treble instruments, like a flute and a violin, or two violins, or an oboe and a flute or something, playing independent parts above the bass line. It's called a trio sonata. Three parts. Bach sits down and writes six of these things, but they're not for three people. They're for one person sitting at an organ.
How can you do that?
So your feet are playing. Your feet are playing the pedal part, the bass line, And the left hand plays one instrument and the right hand plays the other on separate manuals. And so you are playing the part of three musicians at once.
Okay.
And that just scratches the surface of how nuts Bach can get. Every Christmas, I love to play. He has what are called the canonic variations on Vom Himmelhoch, the Christmas chorale. From heaven above to earth I come. That one. So if we don't know what a canon is, you think of the children's rhyme. Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques. And then somebody else starts, and you kind of can chase each other. That's called a canon. Two parts in strict imitation, one delayed from the other, and they accompany each other. Bach has a two- or three-part canon going, and then in the middle of it, here comes the tune. Bom, 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 bom. Mind-bogglingly difficult to do. I mean, you really, after a while, you're like, either this guy's divinely inspired or he came off of a spaceship. One of the two.
I don't know. I still just can't get my head around how you do it, how you read it, how you, I don't know, man.
It's in three lines. Trombone. Normally. So you're usually reading three lines at once. There's right hand, left hand, pedal. Most of the time. Now, the hymnal and things like that, they aren't set up that way, but you can read in two lines just as well as three, usually.
I have a hard enough time following the melody in the hymnal while reading the words. I can't imagine. So one thing that I notice about the organ, because our organist at our church left, and now we have a pianist instead playing the piano. And the organ seems to, maybe it's the windy nature of it, right? But it seems to like really fit with the human voice really well.
So if you think about it, the organ has many of the same qualities of the human voice. For instance, it can sustain notes. Just like the human voice can. Which means the note durations can mimic what the voice is supposed to do. So you can literally sing with the organ because the tone is going to be there the entire time. As soon as you press a key on a piano, the sound is produced and then starts to decay. On an organ, as long as the organ is on and you hold the key down, it will keep going unless it runs out of wind or the power goes out.
Wow. What are the odds it's going to run out of wind?
If it runs out of wind, it was either built very poorly or it has problems. you can get some that are particularly very old instruments that are underwinded or they have a leak, generally speaking. But an organ that's built the way it should be and has been maintained properly shouldn't have that problem.
Do you think it's, I don't want to say like dying, because I don't think that's the right word, but do you think it's sort of becoming less popular as an instrument?
That's a, you've just asked a terribly complicated question.
Excellent. Excellent.
There's a lot.
We got 40 minutes to go, so.
There's a lot of things at play there. I think on the one hand, you have to look at the condition of churches. Because most of your organists are employed in churches. And can they afford to pay people to do this? Can they afford to maintain the instrument? Can they afford to buy an instrument? Can they afford to build an instrument? Then you have, without foundering upon the rocks of the worship wars, you have those churches
that want to do worship wrong. I'm sorry. No, that's going to start a fight. Not wrong. They just want to do it worse.
So, I once got...
They're just like... It's just got like a whole group of Baptists over there who are like, hey, wouldn't it be cooler if we worship the devil with rock and roll music instead?
I got in really deep trouble one time. I walked into a church and the minister's acoustic guitar was sitting on the front pew. And I walked in and looked at him and
broke it.
I walked in and looked at him and pointed at it and said, well, there's your problem. So you've got that. I mean, okay, so, you know, aside from a church's ability to hire somebody and maintain an instrument, et cetera, then you have that church's willingness to do so, mm-hmm. essentially. Where I'm at in very rural Iowa, you know, when I grew up, the church organists were all 75-year-old ladies.
Yeah, right.
And they were itinerant, essentially. You know, they might have had some lessons when they were young, and that was pretty much it. Which influences a whole separate conversation about what is the quality of the church music like in our churches. And then I think the other thing is the fewer people take piano lessons, the fewer people take organ lessons, because organ's like the advanced class in piano. I think a lot of people see it that way.
Yeah, I certainly do. How do you see it that way?
So I don't teach organ lessons to kids who haven't had piano before. That's just a rule I have. I don't do that because I think the piano is necessary in order to play the organ. I do that because I want them to know, you know, be able to read music and be able to sit at a keyboard and know what the keys do, which is a lot easier to teach.
My band teacher.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to teach a 5-year-old how to read music and what the keys do at a piano than to sit him down at this organ console over my shoulder and go, here, look at this complicated giant thing.
my band teacher had a similar approach. He would... he would make a lot of us, not all of us, but he would make a lot of us take a year or two of piano before he would let us into the actual high school band. Just because he thought that piano specifically was so foundational to music, because you can't learn how to, you can't go through a year or two of piano without getting really good foundational music theory, reading music, understanding the way notes fit together, like all this stuff. He found it just foundational for music in general.
So the fun story about how I came to play the organ. mm-hmm. I was in band in middle school and high school. I was a drummer because I didn't want to learn how to read music. It sounded like way too much work to me.
Yeah.
You know, 13-year-olds have so much more on their mind, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I was just in high school, I took piano lessons. And really enjoyed it. Learned how to read music, et cetera, et cetera. And my piano teacher at the time, one of her day jobs was as the accompanist at the local community college, which has an unbelievable jazz music program. And she comes into my lesson one day and she brings with her a copy of Intro to Jazz Piano. And we sit down and start to learn jazz chords and how to play jazz piano. And after about 2 weeks, I looked at her and I said, I never want to do this again. Because I, at the time, detested jazz music. And she says, well, if you never want to have to play jazz, go and learn how to play the organ. And I took her at her word. To this day, I have no idea whether she was kidding. but I took her at her word, and I went and found somebody to teach me organ lessons.
And now you're like a professional organ player. Look at you.
Yeah, something like that. Well, and this is where I think I'm representative of a lot of people who do this, particularly I find in rural areas and in particularly in my experience, the LCMS as a whole, in that I'm not just the church organist. Like, I own a real estate company. That's my day job.
Mm-hmm.
And playing the organ is more or less a paid hobby for me.
Right.
And I think that if you kind of scratch the surface, that is most of the people who play the organ.
Yeah. Our previous organist is an accountant.
I do find, it's funny you say that. I do find most people, if they aren't retired, that play the organ, mm-hmm. tend to be engineers, accountants. I'm a real estate appraiser. Right. That sort of, they're analytical type people.
Yeah. Well, it's a very focused instrument, right? So, like you talked about hating jazz piano. Meanwhile, I played trombone all through high school and for many years afterwards, and playing jazz when I always liked, you know, big like symphonic pieces, and it was fun for all of our like local band festivals and competitions and things. Our band teacher would always select some big score from a movie, like a blockbuster movie, kind of a, mm-hmm. you know, piece that, you know, really big and full, and I was so majestic and soaring, and I loved it. And he was a trombone player himself primarily, so he always picked pieces that benefited us in the trombone section that, you know, put a real focus on our part. And so it was always a lot of fun. But somewhere around junior year, a buddy of mine was like, oh, check this out. It's called a mute. And let's see how this works. And then all of a sudden, me and him are listening to, like, who are the people that are using this thing the best? And it's, like, jazz, man. Like, they're all about using a mute. And so you start listening to jazz like that and, like on brass, and that was so much fun to play. Always so much fun to play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
I'm a big big band kind of guy. Like, in my easy listening, I like Glenn Miller and that sort of thing. That's about as jazzy as I get.
Yeah. It's that's funny. Because, like, I'm not analytical at all. I know for a fact if I sat down at an organ, I would be absolutely overwhelmed. And I'd probably just push random buttons. What all the buttons do?
So there's lots of different kinds of buttons. So obviously you've got the keys and the pedals, and I think we know what those do.
Sure.
The other, so usually either along the top or along the sides, you have the stops. Mm-hmm. And the stops are your choices of sounds. So in a pipe organ, each stop runs a particular set of pipes. And depending on the shape, length, material of those pipes, you will get a different sound.
Oh, I see.
And it's choosing those combinations that create the different
sounds.
So
it's like if I want to do like a lower end bass, kind of a B flat, I'm going to choose these stops and it'll play that through. I have a bajillion pipes. And a large number of them would fit within the range of this specific B flat. And so I'm using the stops to pick which pipes I'm going to push it through.
It's not quite that complicated.
Okay.
So for each, so there's 61 notes on each keyboard. And for each stop, there are 61 pipes.
Okay.
Each pipe is one note. C, C sharp. D, D sharp, so on and so on. And what you do by selecting the stop is A, you select what octave you're going to play it in.
Okay.
And it just so works out, physics is a wonderful thing. It just so works out that middle C is about 4 feet long. That's how long of a pipe you need to make middle C. And you can work up and down from there. But singing pitch, that is the pitch on the page, the lowest note, which is another C, is about 8 feet long.
Huh.
And so an 8 foot stop is at speaking pitch. It's if I sing A and I push the A on the keyboard, I'm going to get the same note. Now, because of how physics works and how harmonics work, if we go to a stop where that base C is 4 feet, we'll go up an octave. If we make that bottom note 16 feet long, we'll go down an octave.
I see.
So you can mix and match those octaves to get mm-hmm. different sounds that you want. But for every stop, there will be 61 notes, regardless.
How many stops can you activate in a single go?
As many of them as the instrument has. So,
wow.
You
could just turn everything on and
yeah,
hit middle C, and
if it doesn't run out of wind, it'll play.
What would it sound like? Would it just be one single note, or would it be one note in varying octaves?
Yeah, it would be one note in varying octaves with perhaps some off octave notes thrown in there too, because there are fractions.
Yeah.
Weird.
I bet you can do a lot. I bet you can do a lot with like choosing the right stops with like harmonics and overtones and getting some really cool sounds out of it.
That is exactly what you do.
Wow.
So take the 8 foot stop we were talking about a minute ago. Mm-hmm. Well, if we add a 4 foot stop, we now have that and the octave.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the first overtone, is the octave.
Mm-hmm.
If we then go up to 2 foot, we have 2 octaves. If we then go 2 2/3 of a foot, we have the note, the octave. We have the fifth, which is the third overtone,
mm-hmm.
and the next octave, which is the fourth overtone. If we then add 1 3/5, we add the third, which is the next overtone. And so on and so on and so on.
And then we're able to play all of this with a single key press.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And by mixing and matching those overtones,
mm-hmm.
you can create all sorts of sounds.
And I know I've heard it, but like now hearing like how that works, putting it together with like things I've heard, just like the rich full sound you get with like a full on chord,
mm-hmm.
a full on melody playing through. I mean, that's
so you that's think wild. About the last funeral I played. I played a funeral last Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And during the prelude music, I'm playing very quietly and softly. And I know one of the pieces I played was, you know, softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling. And the final hymn going out the back door
mm-hmm.
was Lift High the Cross. Well, when you hit the chorus of Lift High the Cross, if you don't have everything going, you're not an organist. I mean, it. You know, everybody's singing at the top of their lungs, then the organ better be too. And you can do all that. It gives you the capability to do this wide range of things, and it's literally a flick of the wrist to go from one to the other.
Hmm.
Extremely versatile.
That's so cool. So you have to have at least one stop then.
Yeah. If you don't put any stops on, then you're doing nothing. You're playing air organ at that point.
So I see, which is funny because that's to be distinguished from actually playing the organ, which is also the air organ. I see in the background you have one.
Yes.
All the folks playing at home aren't going to be able to see this, which is funny. But there, I noticed that there are other things that I can see that aren't. It looks like there's stops down by your feet, even.
So those are
other things down
generically
there.
Called playing aids.
Okay.
So, for instance, below the keyboard, you'll see I'm going to try to get my finger in here. You'll see these small white buttons.
Yep.
Underneath the keyboards. Those are called pistons. And what they do, this is why I can change from one to the other at the flick of a wrist. I can set up a registration. That's what a set of stops is called. Once I've got the set of stops that I want, that's called a registration.
Now, is this an electric organ exclusive thing?
No. Plenty of pipe organs do this. Older instruments, maybe not. Back in the day, before they had the computing power to organize all this, it was a bit more difficult. They did have mechanical ways of doing it, but that's because Victorians were an ingenious bunch.
Yeah.
And I can set up a registration that I want, a set of stops that I want, and I can tell the organ to save that combination.
Okay.
And then when I want that combination back, I press the piston that I saved it on.
Okay, yeah.
And it will automatically go to whatever that registration was. And so it's
preset buttons.
The classic place to do this is between the final two verses of Amazing Grace.
Hmm.
Now you're going to make me find it in the hymnal. because I'm going to get the wording correct. So what kind of church organist am I? I don't even have the number memorized.
Ah, jeez.
I can tell you.
I was going to cut this out, but no.
I can tell you what it was in Lutheran worship. That tells you how long it takes for people like me to adjust to a new hymnal. The new hymnal's been here for 15 years, and I still have to look. So the final verse of Amazing Grace, final two verses. Yes, when this flesh and heart shall fail, and mortal life shall cease, amazing grace shall then prevail in heaven's joy and peace. Yeah, we're talking about death here. And so very somber, very low sounds, very soft sounds. You can almost let the congregation sing it by themselves.
Mm.
But then the last verse, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we'd first begun. I mean, it just begs to have the whole instrument at the end, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Especially the bright shining.
Yeah.
And you just unleash the whole instrument and everybody's at the top of their lungs. And if there's a dry eye in the house, I'd be surprised.
So that's the pistons?
Yep. Allows you to switch registrations very quickly.
Cool. And then the little foot buttons.
They're the same thing.
Are the same thing.
They're called toe studs, but they do the same thing. You can click it with your foot to do exactly the same thing. Because it turns out when you're playing the organ, your hands are kind of busy sometimes.
Right. So it's an instrument designed in such a way that, realistically speaking, it is easier to blindly kick a button on the wall and get the proper result.
Or the improper result.
Whatever.
Every organist has that story about, playing Good Friday or something, and it's, just deathly quiet. The organ is just whispering, and you go to change the registration to bring the 8-foot flute in or something, and you kick the wrong thing or you hit the wrong thing. And here comes like the harmonic trumpet or some big loud, just absolutely scares the wits out of you. We've all done that. Everybody who's played the organ for more than 5 minutes has done that.
It's okay. And we've all heard it too, you know.
Yeah, all of a sudden the organ just goes, wah! And you're like, whoa.
Yep. Seen it happen. So what are those little wooden pedally looking things?
Oh, the gas pedal looking things?
Yeah, it's sort of above the footboard next
right
to the
there.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are what are three of those. That there's two different sets there. They have different jobs.
Oh, good.
So
that's this instrument is how many more layers of complexity can we?
So the organ has the same problem that the harpsichord had, in that a pipe that's being blown into inherently makes the same volume, no matter what you do.
Right. Okay.
So the way you create changes of volume is either by adding or subtracting stops, which will change the quality of the sound, or you stick some of the pipes in a box, and then you put shutters on the front of the box, and you have them actuated pneumatically, and you make a pedal so that it's just like driving a car. You push the pedal forward and things get louder. You pull the pedal back and things get softer.
Huh.
And this particular instrument in my music room has three of those. Three different ones, so I can actually change the volume of any one of the divisions as I want.
Okay.
The fourth one has kind of a special job. It's like a piston on steroids. And okay. it has all the stops on the organ programmed into it in a particular order.
Oh.
So that as you step into it, they come on in a sequence. It's called a crescendo shoe.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's actually a very fitting name.
Yeah, that's another way where you can go from a whisper to the whole thing in an instant. You just kick that, and everything comes on.
What if you were trying to make it loud and you hit the wrong pedal and you made it like super loud?
Again, everybody's done it. Everybody's done it. That absolutely mortifying moment when you realize that you've cut into the middle of the funeral procession with trumpets.
Oh, man. Have you ever done something like that and thought, oh, that's it, they're going to fire me?
Not necessarily that, but I have made apologies a time or two. At one of my previous church jobs, the organ was in the front of the church. And it was in the chancel on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And this instrument had trumpets at 16 and 8.
A legitimate pipe organ.
Oh, yeah. It had a big trumpet at 16 and 8. And it was Easter. And we were doing DS1.
Mm-hmm.
And as you'll recall, this is the feast in DS1. Womp, this is the feast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we just come through Lent, so we'd skip that for multiple weeks on end. And the pastor is up at the altar. I still laugh about this because it was so funny. And I'm in the choir stalls where the organ console is. And so I can see him just out of the corner of my eye. And we get to the end of the Kyrie in DS1, and I step on the low D, which is what you start This Is the Feast with. And he just about shot through the roof. I mean, it was whom, this is, and he could have pole vaulted the altar. It was...
That's great.
But there's things like that's it. The only people who have better stories than church organists are funeral directors.
I'm sure. So it really feels, I mean, it really feels like, and I know it probably, it's a little confirmation bias, I think, because we've been using it in this capacity for like 1,000 years, but it really feels like the organ was made for church music, you know?
Luther says so.
Church music was made for the organ. I don't know.
Luther says so.
Yeah.
I don't have the exact reference here, but I've got my Luther's Work, Volume 53 up here, and I know it's in there somewhere. It talks about Luther saying, if you have an organ, you should use it. I don't remember the exact turn of phrase, but it's something like, the instruments of the minstrels are not appropriate to church.
That seems about right.
And as usual with Luther, he just kind of says it the way it is. There's not like, you could do that. No. Lots of definite articles all over the place.
Yeah. Hands down. It's, big on the, Luther was big on the, being just sort of unnecessarily like whatever the opposite of winsome is.
Yeah.
Like gruff is the word. I don't know. Just blunt. He was just, here's what it is. That's great. So how do you convince people to learn to play this thing?
Honestly, I've never had to talk anybody into it.
Okay. You sit someone down. Go ahead. I was going to say, you sit someone down at this thing for the first time. They've come to you. Mm-hmm. And they want to learn how to play it. You sit them down at it. Where do you start?
Mary had a little lamb.
Okay.
Or Jesus loves me, this I know. And you kind of just start, look, this is how this works. My personal favorite thing, and I wish more people would do this. I'll be playing, say, the postlude after church. Uh-huh. And I'll see people come by and kind of look at what I'm doing, especially if it's, say, Easter or Reformation Day, when I'm really giving them a fireworks show. And they'll stop and they'll look and they'll be really, wow. And then they go on. They don't stop to ask me about it, you know, or something like that. And I'm here to tell you, your church organist wants to tell you about what they do. They want you to be curious. They want you to come look at it. I show the instruments that I play. I work for two churches. I show the instruments that I play to more elementary school kids than I do anyone. Because they come up and they watch and their eyes are the size of dinner plates and they have questions. Mm-hmm. They want to know. And that's how we start.
They haven't learned yet not to ask questions, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But
can you talk and play organ at the same time?
Funeral directors, choir members, and pastors seem to think that you can.
Because you got a lot going on.
Those conversations tend to amount to yeses and nos at best.
All right, so we should watch what you're doing. Because you want us to see it. It's very cool. But we should wait until you're done to ask you about it.
Yeah, that does make life easier.
Got it. That's going to be my homework for all the listeners. I'm going to have them go out and specifically hassle their organist this week. And I'm going to say, tell them Ryan Frederick sent you to hassle your organist.
Yeah, I think it is kind of interesting because I've never seen, just to use an example, I've never seen an LWML lady in my life who was afraid to walk up to a minister and ask them about their sermon or ask them about this or that or whatever. But people avoid the organist like it's the plague for some reason.
It's because you're weird and we don't want to talk to you.
Oh, I know. That was the plan all along.
It's so funny because our organist, before she moved, her and her husband moved, but before they did, like, Carlene, she was great. She was the most fun person. I hope go talk to your organist, folks. They're great. Go criticize them. That's what they want. That's what he said, that the ladies aren't afraid to go up and criticize pastor's sermon. Go criticize the organ playing.
Well, if there's something you want to hear, tell them you want to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have worked around churches long enough now to know that people can't fix things they don't know about.
Hmm.
And that's not to say that, you know, people shouldn't be allowed to have their professional integrity either. I wouldn't expect the LWML meeting to tell the pastor what to preach about. Neither would I expect them to tell the organist what to play. But people like to know these things.
You do music stuff, as we've covered. There are, at least in our hymnal, because we still use the ELCA one at our church. And so there are, at least in ours, I think probably in the LSB, two different renditions of A Mighty Fortress.
The right one and the wrong one.
Correct, yes. The right. Which one is the right one? Let me get you on record. Which one is the right one?
Okay, so you really have a thing for asking questions that answer or that open cans of worms, don't you?
Yes, yes. It's because you're gonna, probably the most fun thing I do.
You're going to get me on to one of my rants.
All right. Can you hear me all right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Yeah, my headphone or my headset cut out there for a second. All right, so you were trying to get me in trouble about which setting of Mighty Fortress to go on, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, which one is the right one?
So, the answer is, drumroll, they're both okay.
Okay. Which one do you prefer?
So, in the entire time that I've worked for LCMS churches, they have all used 656 in LSB, which is the isorhythmic version. Or the rhythmic version, excuse me. The other one, shock, is okay because guess who wrote that setting?
Martin Luther?
Bach.
Oh.
The first one, the rhythmic version is by Luther.
Okay.
The isorhythmic version is by Bach. And if I'm going to let anybody overrule Martin Luther on musical matters, it's probably going to be the greatest musician of all time.
That's fair. That's totally fair.
Which leads to my rant on one of the great failings of all the LCMS hymnals.
Okay, let's hear it.
They don't use the Bach settings of the chorales. They're not even in the book. There's a couple of them. 657, the isorhythmic version of Mighty Fortress being one. Break forth, O beauteous heavenly light, in the Advent section. That's another one. I have, right over here on my desk, I have the Methodist hymnal, the what we call the purple book, the United Methodist hymnal. This is a Methodist book from the early 80s, and it has most of the Lutheran chorales in it, and they use Bach's harmonizations.
So you're telling me that as a part of the treasury and inheritance of the historic Western Church, we Lutherans have the right to claim the greatest musician of all time, and yes, we do not use his music.
And we didn't do it.
Yeah,
we didn't
great.
Do it.
Perfect.
As I Nailed point it. Out to people, first off, if the Methodists can do it, surely we can. I can say that here without getting in trouble.
I hope.
And
I'll link your Twitter handle and we'll find out.
Yeah. Secondly, we Lutherans get to lay claim to the greatest theologian since the Church Fathers. I don't think that's stretching things.
Mm-mm, not at all. A couple of them, I would even say.
Yeah, yeah. Probably at least three of the top five.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to lay claim to easily the greatest church musician of all time and probably the greatest musician of all time. And we should probably grab both of those things with both hands.
Right. Yeah.
Hence awesome. My t-shirt.
That's great. That's
it's an
awesome.
AC/DC logo, but it's B-A-C-H.
I'm going to see if I can find that, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. That's awesome. So, which Concordia is the best one? No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to drag you into that. Everyone knows it's Fort St. Louis, Wayne.
Yeah.
They're both good. They're both good seminaries. All right, that's the official stance.
Yeah.
Ryan, thank you so much for squeezing it in here and making time for me. This was a blast. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, anytime. I like this kind of thing.